You've heard the headlines. Get some perspective now with Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Hey, good morning and a happy Tuesday to you. There's no way to get around it. We kick the show off today with the continuing crisis along our southern border.
The Lead. Brought to you by Burge Ford off the U.S. 60 and Mesa Drive.
Yeah, and what has everybody talking this morning, Bruce, is an audio recording obtained by ProPublica that adds some real-life sounds of suffering to a contentious policy debate that has been short on input from those most at stake, immigrant children. More than 2,300 of them have been separated from their parents since April, with the Trump administration launching its zero-tolerance immigration policy, calls for prosecuting all people attempting to illegally enter the country and taking away the children they brought with them.
Yeah, I mean, there is so many different angles to this, but listen, I think the one, and you could certainly make an argument that is most important, and the one that's most impactful to people is the humanity argument. Thinking about and understanding children, and we had a guest yesterday, so we know some were as young as 4 years old. This is in the facility down in Tucson, southern Arizona. This is from an employee inside there. 4 years old to 17 years old. But thinking of a 4, 5, 6, 7-year-old kid who maybe doesn't speak English in the United States for the first time, away from home, being separated from their parents and being housed in a facility. And again, I hesitate because I see so many people out there, you know, making the Nazi comparisons. And again, these facilities, I think, are doing the best they can with what they have. They're not stacking kids like cordwood, you know, in a jail cell. That's not what it's like. Now, is it a place you and I would like to go vacation in? Probably not.
Okay, conditions are one thing. The more important thing are these children. And when you talk about 4, 5, 6-year-olds being separated from their parents, at 4, 5, and 6, a lot of kids can't even have a sleepover at a relative's house without crying for mom and dad.
You worry about your child's safety. You worry about...
Like parents here in Phoenix, think about this. You have a 4, you have a 5, you have a 6-year-old. Are they comfortable enough leaving you for a night to go sleep at grandma's house? Sometimes that in and of itself
is a challenge.
Yet ProPublica has this audio recording. It's been making the rounds. We're going to play some of it for you here. We got some translations over top of a Border Patrol agent who's talking above these children. But I mean, it's heart-wrenching. We're not just playing it for effect. We're trying to give you perspective, the humanitarian perspective, not the politics, not who's right, who's wrong. These are kids, folks. You know, so many of those kids, Bruce, they're so young. Some of the only words they know are mom and dad. Mommy, daddy. I mean, like...
It's the only thing they can speak.
That's the only thing they know. Okay, so you got the Border Patrol agents saying, oh, we have an orchestra here. Because you've got 10 children all crying for their parents. And then you have this 6-year-old little girl... Salvadorian little girl who just wants someone to call her aunt. She memorized the phone number of her aunt, rattles it off at one point in time to the representative. My mommy says that I'll go to my aunt.
Now, that is important on some levels because there is the understanding the policy, understanding how it's being applied, and then learning that there are exceptions to every rule is part of the difficulty in getting a grasp on what's going on. If and when children are found at the border, either they present themselves for asylum or they come with a parent and they're separated, the policy is to place that child with a family member in the United States if they can find a family member. That is the policy. Even if that family member is in the country illegally, that is irrelevant to placing the child. So they do, we're told they make an attempt to do that. The question is, are they so overwhelmed that they're behind on this? How long is that process taking? Are family members less willing to come forward because they think this is some sort of a ruse, especially if you were in the country illegally? Would you be more concerned with raising your hand and going and picking up a niece or a nephew because you think it's merely an opportunity to smoke you out in some way, shape, or form with this new climate, if you will, around immigration? That there are a lot of factors going on at once.
You know, I heard a heartbreaking interview this morning, and I think it's one that most parents, if they put themselves in this mom's shoes, they do the same thing. It was a mom from Guatemala, and she had a son. And the son was about 10 years old, and already at the age of 10, the gangs were trying to get him to join. And so they were approaching him at school, 10 years old. And he had told them no, no, no. And then they said, you either join or we're going to kill your mom and your sister. The mother then, fearing not only for her life, but her children's life, goes, if we stay here, we're going to die. If I make the journey to the United States and I get separated, at least my children live. Life and death situations. Because the question then becomes, if you know you are going to be separated from your children at the U.S. border as a parent, would you still take that risk?
The answer is yes.
And you've got so many parents saying yes, because if I stay, we die. That's the reality of the situation for some of these. Now, when
not
you
all.
Look at the amount of children that are in these detention centers all along the border, roughly 7,000 of them were unaccompanied minors. They came across themselves. They had no adult with them. They weren't with a parent. There's an additional 3,000 that have been added since Jeff Sessions and the Trump administration has changed the zero tolerance policy. Those additional 3,000 are coming from families that have been separated. Families that say, when your only alternative is risk losing your child to a system and not knowing where to find them or death. I mean, as a parent, I know which one I'd choose.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And I think one of the frustrating things for so many people watching this is that immigration reform, immigration laws, amnesty slash asylum, entering the country illegally, economic issues. Okay, fine. Children from infants to 17 years old are the ones paying the price right now. They're the ones that are bearing the brunt of the punishment because of all of those different reasons.
And is that who we are as a country? A country that punishes children? Because that's not the ideals that I grew up with in this country or what I thought that we represented.
I really believe there'll be some sort of day of reckoning on this. You'll be judged based on how you treat the less fortunate, how you treat those who are the most vulnerable. And if you're cheering for kids to be locked up in jail, you know, I'll save you a warm spot in hell next to me. Don't get me wrong, but just understand where you're headed.
So we want you guys to chime in, give you an opportunity to speak on this very important issue, one that's impacting us right here in Arizona. Yesterday, if you missed it, we talked to a guy who worked down in one of the detention facilities in Tucson and telling us what he had experienced and what he had seen there. If you missed any of that, well, then you can go back on our podcast, subscribe to it even on your Android or your iPhone and listen to it there. But we want to hear from you as to how you think this should be handled. What should the resolution be? 602-200-2733. 602-200-2733. It's our open mic line. It's open 24/7, and we give you 24 seconds to sound off. The open mic line is brought to you by Carol Royce with Keller Williams Realty East Valley.
We'll continue with some more of the reaction and, kind of how we got here, including we have a guest coming up at 10 o'clock. If you can come back or stick around till then, work for Customs and Border Patrol. We're going to talk about those actual policies and specifically what changed. We're going to do that and continue this discussion about our southern border, immigration, and kids being on the forefront of that.
Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Allow me to quote something I saw on Twitter, which I thought was relatively interesting and very relevant to this. Yes, crossing the border without documentation is illegal.
Yes.
Being black without a white owner was illegal. Walking into a whites-only restaurant was illegal. In Germany, being a Jewish person was illegal. Without ethics, laws are just the stories we tell to justify horror. Laws change. People change. Times change. Using unjust laws to justify mistreating children says something about who you are. There is no law, immigration or otherwise, that justifies mistreating children. Period. Full stop.
Okay, but are you then advocating for no borders? Because you have to have borders.
That is not the opposite of having ethics is not open borders. You can still treat children humanely. You can still treat people humanely.
No, but you do not have to
separate people.
Let me finish.
And you can still have borders.
But just based upon that tweet there, I agree with you. But that very first line is, I don't know, do you want to read it again?
Crossing the border without documentation is illegal.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because
it's a misdemeanor.
Because we have a border.
It's like a traffic ticket.
Okay, but that's still, and I understand, when you have a traffic ticket in the United States,
we don't take your kids away from you, and
I get all of that, but yeah. I mean, we do have borders, and so I think that that's a little bit different. We're conflating a couple of different things there.
There's been plenty of laws over times to justify bad behavior.
What I wanted to dive into is what's changed. Because this
different?
Whole idea of families coming to said border is nothing new.
It's been going on for decades.
It didn't just happen with
right?
the Trump administration. No. It happened with the Obama administration, the Bush administration,
Clinton,
the Clinton, the
Bush,
yeah.
Reagan,
okay, so
Carter.
This is nothing new. So I wanted to do some digging to go, okay, well, how have we handled families coming to the border in the past? Because I am not an advocate for catch and release. All right. So if you don't catch and release and you don't separate parents from children, what has happened in the past? So Senator Chris Van Hollen shed a little light on this, which I think is a really important distinction. Take a listen, Bruce. Right.
The previous administration had what was called a family case management program. Families were kept together as their asylum claims were processed. If they were granted asylum, the family stays. If they were denied asylum, the family leaves. But they're kept together during that process. So we obviously don't need legislation to do it. We right. just need for Trump to reverse his position.
I'm for that. I think that that is the solution.
Like, that's a humane, ethical way to deal with it.
Okay, we're on the same page.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with that. We have borders. We have laws. You come to this country. You're seeking asylum. We need to determine whether or not you should be granted asylum in this country. Until that determination is made, we're going to hold on to you, but we're going to let you stay with your kids because that, too, is what we're about in America. I think that that's the way it should be, not just catch them and release them, but instead of just putting kids in revamped Walmarts down in Brownsville, Texas, why not keep families together?
Yeah, and to be clear, something did change, and it was an executive order signed by President Trump. As much as he wants to say the Democrats' law, that is factually incorrect.
It was an executive order?
Yes. Okay. It was an executive order signed that had to do with changing the interpretation and the way that the policy is enforced.
Okay.
Because, to be clear, this has not always been happening under the Trump administration. President Trump has been
president for
a year and a half.
This has been going on 6 weeks.
Because of a signature on a piece of paper from President Trump, not because of a law Democrats passed, not because of anything else changed, specifically because of that, and specifically based on interpretations of existing law and how they chose to enforce specific laws. And they have, again, they can't keep their story straight. It depends on who you want to believe. Again, I mentioned President Trump says it's Democrats' fault. You had Stephen Miller said, nope, we're doing it as a position of policy. The DHS secretary says, no, we're not doing it. So, you know, choose who you want to believe. But it appears to be a policy to put pressure on lawmakers to give President Trump money for a wall, which I thought Mexico was going to pay for, by separating children and creating pain.
Okay, when you talk about political pressure, the president and the administration is getting under a lot of pressure right now, especially when you have the likes of Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz, of all people.
A liberal. Granted,
I know that he is running for re-election, but quickly, I want you to hear a little bit of his proposed legislation.
We can stop this. So the legislation that I'm filing this week would prohibit separating families, would mandate that kids should stay with their parents.
Okay, Republican.
Which is what used to happen under the interpretation and is not happening now under the new interpretation.
Chime in for us on the open mic line. How should this all be handled? What is the resolution? 602-200-2733.
So we have results of the AZ merit testing starting at third grade, which I believe it's the first time they do it. I would say it doesn't look very good. Our third graders in the state of Arizona are struggling, and we know that if you're struggling in the third grade, it only gets worse. Tell you what, we'll tell you the story. Dig into it coming up next on Arizona's News Station.
Take a look. It's in a book, a reading rainbow.
Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
So we're getting some results, the preliminary AZ merit results. For those of you that may not be familiar, AZ merit is the standardized testing, right, for kids in the state of Arizona. It's how we measure how well they're doing or how not well they're doing. Okay, did I just get a C on that?
Yes, you did. Your grammar.
Yeah, we're finding out that looking at third graders, and we believe that third grade is the first year of testing.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah, it is.
So third grade is when they do it. We found 56%. Again, I'm not very good at the math part, but I'm pretty sure that's more than half. 56% of Arizona third graders are not proficient in reading.
Yeah. And
that's not good.
Scores have gone up 4 percentage points since 2015. So they're getting better, but they still stink. And when you hear only 44% of third graders in the state of Arizona are reading proficient, it's bad. So when parents have their children take these tests, they're going to get a grade back, a performance level back. And a child is either going to be minimally proficient, partially proficient, proficient, or highly proficient.
Okay.
And we're seeing that the majority of students tested into the lowest category of minimally proficient. So even if they are getting into that 44%, most of them are just squeaking by getting into that 44%. And here's why that is such a big deal. Third grade, and I know this because I am soon to have a third grader. Riley just finished second grade and is going to be going into third next year. It is a critical year. It is the absolute one of the most critical years in a child's education system. Why? Why not second grade or fifth grade or eighth grade? Well, a lot of it has to do with the way that we learn. And in the first 3 years of elementary school, there's a lot of time dedicated to learning to read.
We hope so, yeah.
Learning to read. And beginning in fourth grade, the focus starts to shift where you read to learn. So you've got the subject.
You go from picture books?
Well, you go from just being able to read the words and to string words together to start comprehending what you're reading. Yes,
reading
exactly.
Reading to learn, reading to understand.
Which is going to be critical when it comes to getting into history or getting into math and science. And you need that literacy in order to progress.
In anything moving forward, right? I mean, if you are not proficient in the language moving forward, everything becomes harder from there on out. It reminds me, and I remember seeing some studies about, I'll call them divergent paths, that once you start falling behind in school, it's almost impossible to catch up. Once you're not able to read at the level, once you're not able to do math at the level, good luck ever catching up, because kind of the train rolls on without you. You know what I'm saying? And you're running along as fast as you can, and you'll never grab it.
So there was some folklore out there that says, you know, public officials forecast prison construction based on a state's third grade literacy rate. The Atlantic even did an article on it. It's an urban myth that should be true. And it says that U.S. prison planners don't use local third grade reading scores to predict future inmate populations, but they should, because if you cannot read by the third grade, you are four times less likely to graduate. High school dropouts are three times more likely to be incarcerated than high school graduates. So not reading by third grade may dramatically increase one's chance of being imprisoned.
But you can see the fundamental problem. And I guarantee you one of the issues is, and this is just from knowing teachers, that English is not always first language.
Mm-hmm.
That we have a lot of kids, especially you can imagine in third grade, who are not even maybe as proficient in English as they should be, which would then in turn make it more difficult.
Sure.
I'm making some assumptions here, but I think they're fair assumptions. But again, knowing that, you're starting them down a path where the end is failure in education.
So, again, you know, Riley just finished second grade, is going into third grade, where she will have the AZ merit test next year.
Ooh, I can't wait to read her report. You're going to share all of it, let's be honest.
She is not a reader.
What do you mean?
She doesn't like to read.
Oh, that breaks my little heart.
This is a kid who's totally into science and math and will build projects and will just totally get lost in all of that. But she doesn't have a passion for reading. So as her mom and knowing this, and I mean, heck, her aunt is a high school principal, or excuse me, a elementary principal who used to be a reading coach. You think it breaks your heart, it breaks her aunt's heart.
But, as a former reading coach.
Exactly. So I have to work with her on it. I have to force her to read 20 minutes a day. And we have to find books that she's into. Not books I'm into, but books that she's into.
But that's what helped me with reading.
I wanted to ask parents out there, though, because I know this is something I'm doing with my daughter. You know, it's summer break. She's going into third grade. We hear of the summer brain drain where, you know, kids are off for a couple of months and they kind of lose retention of what they've learned in that grade they just finished. Do you have your kids, I don't want to say study, but like, you know, work during the summer on different, like, you know, school skills? Like, I have Riley read 20 minutes a day. She has to turn over the little globe in 20 minutes. Okay, when that's done, you know, you can put it away. I make her read every day because I know that that is a challenge for her. And so I want to make sure she doesn't lose whatever she has gained last year. So do you make your kids study during the summer, mom, dad? If so, what do you make them do and why do you make them do it? Chime in on our open mic line, 602-200-2733. Do you just let them play all summer? The kids need a break, let them run around with their hair on fire? Or do you set aside some time each day to work on some skills so they don't have that brain drain? 602-200-2733. Our open mic line brought to you by Carol Royce with Keller Williams Realty East Valley.
Hey, do I get credit that I didn't even bring up the fact that teachers are getting a pay raise, and should I expect these test scores to go up now? I didn't even bring that up. What do I get for the pay raise? I'm fine with the pay raise. Here's your expectation. Kids are going to do better. So, have you been watching the World Cup? You know, a lot of people have, but you wouldn't be surprised if, even when you're flipping by or seeing highlights, there are a lot of people dressed as empty seats. This is like supposed to be the biggest sporting event in the world, right? And they can't sell out these tiny stadiums? Is it just soccer? We're going to talk about what's going on with all these empty seats. Coming up next on Arizona's News Station.
KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Get some perspective.
Song.
Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
That's the song you like, right?
That's
the Olé song.
Yeah, the Olé song.
Yeah. World Cup, obviously, rolling on. Day six of the World Cup, for those of you that you're checking your pool. I know people do that. Senegal is beating Poland 2-0. if you will. Japan beat Colombia earlier. A little bit of an upset. I'm not going to throw that out there. But one of the things, and even I noticed it, Pamela, keep in mind that the games are being held at multiple sites all around Russia. They're not just being held at one stadium. You can understand that, right? Or even in one city.
Yes, I can understand that. Thank
you. Well, no, because I had some people like, what do you mean they have to travel to a game? And I go, well, they're not all held in the same place. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the United States, it's going to be held in, what, like 16 cities or whatever. So, there's different size stadiums. You go to Moscow, they have like these huge stadiums. It probably holds 80,000 people. But some of them are, I would argue, relatively small stadiums, 30,000, 40,000 people. And if you've been watching, you'll notice I haven't seen one game, Pamela, that looked even remotely sold out.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting to me. So there were some 6,000 empty seats for the Uruguay-Egypt game. Oh, like okay. The stadium was just at about 80% capacity.
And it's not a huge stadium to begin with.
So you've got FIFA wondering what's going on.
What the heck's going on?
Then you've got this other story, same vein, different story, though, about your team, the Washington Redskins.
Yeah.
And how the Redskins have now admitted that nobody's actually been waiting for season tickets, despite this supposed waiting list.
So,
for over like 200,000 people.
If I get the numbers, the years wrong, you'll excuse me because I wasn't alive. My dad bought Redskin season tickets in 1966 or 1967 before RFK Stadium was built. By the way, they're already playing in a different stadium since then. Even after my father passed away, the tickets went to my brother, and we held on to our season tickets for seats in the for the Redskins. Because of that, you can never get on the list again. That if you were to get on the list, it takes 30 years to get your season
tickets.
And
we hear that with the Green Bay Packers and things along those lines. The connection between these two stories I want to make for folks is it just better to watch a sporting event at home than to go see it in person?
There is plenty of argument. And listen, you could say the Diamondbacks, the Suns, even the Cardinals rarely sell games out.
They're always do.
There's empty seats at almost every sell out. All these people, again, dressed as empty seats. You can get tickets, and we know that sports in general, I'm not trying to pick on the Cardinals, that wasn't the point, that live sports in general are struggling to get people to show up to a stadium anywhere for any sport.
So why
NASCAR,
is that?
Everything.
Why is that? What stops you from going to a live event? Give us a call on the open mic line, 602-200-2733. What stops you from going to a live event? 602-200-2733. I'll tell you.
Okay.
Not a big fan of crowds. Okay?
I'm there with you.
As I've gotten older, don't like being around a bunch of people, okay?
I don't like the crush of humanity.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
I'm not
like
a big
this
fan
is my
that.
Personal dance space, this is your personal dance space,
you
okay?
Need dance space.
The other thing. I got a refrigerator full of the beer I like.
Yes.
Not the swill
Some
that you sell at
craft
these
brew orange peel dog heads whatever.
And IPA. Guess what? It doesn't cost $12 a pint.
Ouch. So expensive? Crowds, can I throw in there, and I don't know if maybe this is the overreaching umbrella, I find live sporting events very inconvenient. I find there to be so many hoops that I need to jump over that eventually I just go, that's enough.
And now they want me to put all of my stuff in a clear purse and walk in through security because
I look ridiculous with a clear purse. Not bringing one.
It's not worth it. And apparently there are other rules that I'm unaware of. Like if I show up with my regular purse, what happens now? I got to go back to the car and dump things out.
You just don't want me to come.
Exactly.
That's what I say at some point. You just don't want me here. It's okay.
And hey, I've got a better seat,
comfy
my couch,
right?
Bathroom's right there.
Okay.
I'm still going to enjoy the game, but then when it's over, I get to go do something else. I don't have to wait in the parking lots for an hour.
That might be my worst
to
thing.
Get somewhere.
Leaving.
What stops you? We sound like curmudgeons.
Right,
what stops
today.
You from going to a live event, concert, sporting event, whatever it may be? Give us a call on the open mic line, 602-200-2733.
Yeah, you could get tickets for games tomorrow at the World Cup. No problem.
Like I
good
enjoyed
seats still available well at halftime.
When I was a kid, I enjoyed going with my dad. Like
it was
as
an
a kid,
experience.
I love doing those things. As I've gotten older, I'm like, yeah, no.
I'll take
Riley so that she has those experiences, but like just going on, you know, with Chris and I, no thanks.
Okay. I can't argue with you. You know what I mean? Children separated from their parents at the border. We are going to talk to the former chief of staff for the United States Customs and Border Protection. Yes. That conversation. And trying to understand more from his perspective. Coming up next on Arizona's News Station.